Doug Rowell, gjörðu svo vel.
Hello, everyone. My name is Doug Rowell, and I am a grateful alcoholic. Hi, Doug. I like that. I want to tell you, when I was 6 years old, I was in the first grade, and I had just come to the first grade from summer. We were off school in the summer, and we just came back in the fall to school. And my first grade teacher said, "I want everyone in the room come up to the front of the room and tell us what you did this summer." It was in Los Angeles area, and one of my contemporaries came up and in the front and said, "My family went to Boston this summer," and told about going to Boston and seeing all the ancient sites of Boston, and someone else went to Niagara Falls, and I didn't do anything in the summer, and I felt less than. So after I was maybe 10 or 11, number 10 or 11 of the students, and I went up and I looked at the map on the way up, map of the globe, and I picked out a place. And I said, this summer, my family went to Iceland. We went to Iceland, we flew there, and the airplane landed, and we had to put on these big coats with fur on the face and bundle up. And I didn't know anything about Iceland except that the name was Iceland. And of course, I achieved the desired effect. Everyone was very impressed. A few weeks later, when they had what they call a parent-teacher conference, and the parents come and talk to the teacher, and my teacher asked my mother, "How is it that your family decided to go to Iceland for the summer?" And my mother said, "What? What makes you?" She said, "Yeah, Doug told us that you went to Iceland." My mother said, "No, we were going to go to Arizona, but we decided not to." So that was the last time I thought about Iceland until Carl called me a few months ago. Carl, you know Carl, who started Alcoholics Anonymous in Iceland. Is that right? We tease Carl. He actually was influential in helping to some functions in AA get started in Iceland. But Carl called me and asked me, "Would you like to go to Iceland?" And I said, "Yeah, yes, I would." You know, so I can hardly. When I get back, I'm going to see if my first grade teacher is still alive. I did go to Iceland. I actually thought, probably until I was well over 50 years old, that when you landed in a plane in Iceland, you actually did have to put on an Eskimo parka. I didn't know anything about this country. My girlfriend got me a book about Iceland, and I was amazed as I turned the pages and found out that there is culture and art. There's a theater and sculpture. And has been for some time, evidently. It seems like if I had come here in the first grade, that's what I would have found. And so I'm just delighted to be here. I like doing this. I know some very, very good AA speakers in Los Angeles who you love to hear them speak because they talk about the steps and the spiritual awakening and the sober life in a way that is so inspiring, but they don't like doing it. They'd rather not, and they're embarrassed. When they're asked to do it, they do it because they're courageous and they're dedicated. And I'm not either one of those things, but I don't even know if I'm a good speaker, and I really couldn't care less. But I love doing it. I love doing this. I think that talking at an Alcoholics Anonymous function is the most fun you can have with your pants on. When someone calls me and says, would you like to come to our town and talk about yourself for an hour? Yes, I would. Yes, I would. I really would. But that's the way I am. I wanted to be the speaker at the first meeting I ever went to. But I was a little drunk. I could walk, you know, but I was noticeably intoxicated, and so they didn't ask me. They almost never do. They hardly ever say, "Hey, let's get the drunk guy to talk." But they welcomed me. They welcomed me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a matter of fact, it was a meeting. It was a Friday night speaker meeting. I don't remember who spoke or what they said. I don't remember. But I remember things that happened at the meeting. Before the meeting started, three separate people, two men and a woman, individually, not a welcoming committee, three separate people, noticed there's a new guy here, came over to me, put out their hand, and said, "You're new." And it wasn't a question. They said, "You're new." And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Welcome. Keep coming back." And I don't know if that's a common phrase in Iceland, but in the United States, they always say, "Keep coming back." You can get up and say, "I hate Alcoholics Anonymous. I think you're all a bunch of morons. You just follow each other. You follow each other right off the cliff like a bunch of lemmings. I'm out of here. I'll never come back." And we say, "Keep coming back." In fact, if there's someone here tonight who is new, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, you may have some ideas, some really good ideas about how to improve Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you do, I'd like to suggest that you talk to Siggy up here and tell him your ideas. And chances are Siggy will say, "Keep coming back." Because that's what we say. You should keep coming back. At my first meeting, the three people that said, "Keep coming back," made me feel like I was wanted here. People in my life, people who genuinely cared about me, people who loved me, were not saying, "Keep coming back." People who knew me were saying, "Don't come over here. Stay away, Doug." "Hello, it's Doug. Hey, listen, I thought I'd come and visit for a while. Are you guys home?" No, we're not, Doug. No, we're just leaving. We're just walking out the door. Yeah, we won't be home for a long time. So, don't come over here. Okay. Love you, Mom. I'm not kidding. I got uninvited to a wedding. They invited me. First, they invited me. They sent me the too many envelopes and all the stuff that they send for wedding invitations. And I responded, "Yes, I'm coming to the wedding," and sent it back. I bought them a wedding present. I wrapped it. It was sitting on my table waiting for Saturday morning when the wedding was. And my friend Bob called Thursday night, and he said, "Doug," I said, "What's up, Bob?" "Well, you know, Carol and I have been talking about it, and we'd like for you to not come to the wedding." And I, you know, most people, normal people, if they got a call like that, would, if not offended, would at least be curious. You know, I'm like, "Why is that, Bob? Gosh, I hope it's not anything I did." You know, did you overbook the room? I mean, you need the room. I didn't say that. In fact, it seemed like a good idea to me. "Good idea, Bob. Tell Carol I'm really proud of her. That's very courageous to do that, and it's a good idea." Because we had all been at a wedding the weekend before that, and you know the term moon? I mooned the bride's mother. which, if you're not acquainted with colloquial English, that means I pulled down my pants and stuck my ass out at the bride's mother. The bride's mother. And, you know, see, that's considered, in California, that's a social faux pas. Yeah, you're not supposed to do that. And so, at a wedding, I didn't go there to moon the bride's mother. I went there to be part of a joyful experience for friends of mine. And they had an open bar where you don't pay for the drinks. Why do they do that? Bad combination. Open bar, invite Doug. Everybody was dancing and laughing and having a good time, and I just thought, you know what, it'd be funny to show my ass. So I pulled down my, hey! And boy, all of a sudden you could have heard a pin drop in there. It was silent. And it shouldn't have been, somebody should have laughed. That's what I intended. And I thought people were going to go, man, that Doug is crazy, you know? He's a crazy guy, man. But they did. But friends of mine pulled me. And when everybody's quiet and you know people should be laughing, it's a real uncomfortable for a moment. Because all you can do is casually get dressed, act like nothing happened. So that's what I did. But friends of mine pulled me aside and said, hey, man, what's the matter with you? What's wrong with you, man? You mooned the bride's mother, Doug. Excuse me. I thought it was the groom's mother. Come on, hey, lighten up. I didn't do it in the ceremony. Was that the reception, for Christ's sake? What am I, an animal? Come on, hey. So they knew I didn't get it, and somebody nicknamed me Doug Scusting, that was my nickname for a long time, Doug Scusting, result of that. So what I'm saying is, for strangers, people I never met, to come up to me and say, "Keep coming back," was not something I was used to. At all. And that wedding, I didn't go to the wedding that I was uninvited to, and it seemed like it came off all right. I didn't hear anything bad about it. I had already bought him a wedding present, but that's okay. I just drank it myself. I see heads nodding. You know what I'm talking about. I tell you, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew I wasn't going to fit. I knew I wouldn't fit here. I never fit any place in my life. I didn't fit in school, because I lied to him about Iceland, probably, you know. But I didn't fit in school, and I didn't fit in the workplace, and I didn't fit in my own family. In high school, people liked me all right. They didn't dislike me, but I didn't fit anywhere. I played sports. I played football, not what we call soccer. You call football. Most of the world calls it football, but we already had a football when soccer got there, so we call it soccer. But I played American football, and I liked football. I enjoyed it. I had a good time. But I wasn't a jock. I wasn't a sports person. And I knew it, and the jocks knew it. So I didn't fit there. And surfing. I grew up in California. Everybody surfed. I surfed. I liked surfing. I was a good surfer. But I wasn't a surfer. You know, I surfed, but I wasn't a surfer. And I surfed with the surfers, but I wasn't one, and I knew it, and they knew it. I love motorcycles. Since I was 15 years old, I've always had a motorcycle. I was always building a motorcycle and riding a motorcycle. I love motorcycles, but I wasn't a biker. I never was a biker. I rode with the bikers. I wasn't one. They knew it, and I knew it. And that's just the way it's always been. So when I came to AA, I knew I wasn't going to fit here. There was a lot of reasons. For one, you all were not drinking. I knew that. I knew that alcoholics in AA didn't drink. But you seemed to be awfully happy about it. And that was not going to be my case. If indeed I stopped drinking, I was going to be unhappy about it. which was okay because I had been happy a long time. And I had used up my share of laughing, you know. No more laughing for Doug. Time to get serious and get sober. And then I went and I saw these people. They're just so happy. They had this smile that I called it Jesus sunshine smile. You know, it was just like, you know, instead of saying, "Do you know my Lord?" They would say, "How long are you sober?" any day now. But my first meeting, I mean, the three people came up and said, "Keep coming back." And I'll tell you something else. In California, most of the United States calls the celebration of years of sobriety anniversaries. But in California, we don't. We call them birthdays. Because when you have an anniversary, you just have a meeting once a month, and everybody who got sober in that month will celebrate and talk, you know, say thank you. But in California, Southern California anyway, we call them birthdays, and then you get to have a cake with candles on it and sing. And they sing, "Happy birthday to you." Everybody sings, and they sing off-key as a rule. Now, I didn't know this, so when I went to my first meeting, they said, "We have a big a treat tonight. Ruth is celebrating her 18th birthday." And I'm going, so I thought, well, hey, this is kind of cool. They celebrate people's birthdays. You know, if I stay here till May, they'll celebrate my birthday. So I'm looking around for Ruth. I know Ruth is some 18-year-old tiny hiney, you know. And she's... so I'm looking around for Ruth, and Ruth gets up. Ruth looked good. She was presentable. She was made up, dressed up, and happy. But she was 50 years old if she was a day. And I looked at and I thought, if she's 18, she needs to stop drinking. Yeah. You see, she looked good. She didn't look bad. She's just a little whipped for a teenager. And then I realized that the woman could not be 18 years old. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't drink here. Then why would they celebrate somebody's birthday? She's sober 18 years. This woman has not drank for 18 years. I didn't know that you did that. And then they did something else I didn't know they did. They started singing, "Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday, dear Ruth." And I'm just going, but in four different keys. And tickled about it. Nobody's going, "Excuse me, are we in the same key here?" They're just singing and just delighted about it. And I'm just thinking, okay, I'm definitely not going to fit here. Because I have a musical background. And participating in dissonant off-key choruses is irritating to me. And plus, it's lame. It's real lame. It's a level of lameness I never imagined existed. And I thought, if I was going to make up something about AA to make fun of it, I wouldn't have thought of the singing happy birthday thing. They get out, and Ruth gets up to the podium, and she says, "My name is Ruth, and I'm an alcoholic." That's when everybody says, "Hi, Ruth!" And I'm just, oh, man. I was like, I was so embarrassed for you all, because I was so cool that I not only didn't sing off-key with you, I didn't even sit down at my first meeting. There was about maybe 300 people at that meeting, good-sized meeting. There were chairs. There were empty chairs. I could have sat down. In fact, people came up. I was leaning against the back wall. Like this. "Show me something. Let's see what you got." And people would come up to me and say, would you like to sit down? There's a chair over here." "No, that's all right. I'm fine here. I'm not a member. I'm just viewing. I'm visiting. I'm auditing the class. I'm just checking it out. Okay. In fact, I'm not a loner. I'm not a joiner. I'm an outlaw. I'm a desperado. Yeah, I'm a loner. In fact, don't get used to me around here because I'll break your heart. You'll be looking around. Where's Doug? I'll be so gone. I'm gone. I'm long gone. Where's Doug? I'll break your heart. Just don't get used to me around here, outlaw desperado, okay? Not a joiner. All right. Well, can you kind of keep it down? We're trying to have a meeting over here. Yeah, fine. So, I wasn't sitting. I was standing against the back wall. But there was another guy. Two of us were too cool to sit. We were the cool section. We were like back there. But this other guy, I found out, was a member. His job in that meeting was he was a newcomer catcher. So he stood against the back wall looking cool. See? He was the coolest looking guy they had at the meeting. So they put him back there to catch me, obviously. When Ruth says this, Ruth gets up to take her cake. Hi, Ruth. I want you to know that over this last 18 years of sobriety, I have attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. Some of the people in that meeting went, wow. Some people went, ooh, every day. Me, I'm at the back, I'm going, whoa, you kind of dumb, huh? I'm going to go out on a limb and say, you're just a little slow, right, Ruth, you know? I look over at this other cool guy. That's when I found out he's the newcomer catcher because he gives me that Jesus sunshine smile. Tell you what, you stay sober a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. What? Stay sober a year? Don't drink any alcohol for a year? And I get a cake? Hey, there's a deal. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm in. Yeah. I don't know what I was thinking not joining up. A cake of my own. I tell you, I said, you know, I'm really not much of a pastry eater, really. If I wanted one, I'd just stop at the market on the way home, you know, pick one up, $5, you know. In fact, it wouldn't even be out of my way. I'm going to stop and get a six-pack on the way home anyway. So I didn't get it. And as I said, I don't remember anything the speaker said. But I remember that the secretary of that meeting got up and made some announcements. And I remember some people read some stuff. And the secretary said, she held up our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, this is our big book. It's the basic text of our program. It's the only authority on Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember that. And she said, if you're new, don't leave without this book. So I said, oh, I made a mental note. Okay, steal the book. I used to always make these mental notes, and then I'd lose my mind, you know. Where's that note? I was going to steal the book. I had it figured out just like this. I know if I go pick up that book, I can act like I'm fascinated with it, reading the book, walk right out the door, and nobody would stop me. Nobody would stop me. They'd say something like, let him go. And I still think that would happen. But the secretary ruined that because she said, if you're new and you're financially embarrassed, don't let that keep you from getting this book. We sell this book at our cost, $3.75. And if you're new and you don't have the money, we'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week until you get back on your feet. Well, that sounds very loving and generous. But from my point of view, now if I steal the book, you're going to think I'm not on my feet. And I cannot have that. So I went up to the secretary after the meeting. I said, I'd like to buy one of those books, please. And she said, it's $3.75. And I said, here's a $5. Keep the change. She said, I'll get your change. No. Use it. Use it to help a drunk or something, you know. Yeah. I'm on my feet, okay? Got the book, and I took it home. And Now, I was a little disappointed in Alcoholics Anonymous, even though there were some good things that happened, like the people telling me to keep coming back, and I could get around that birthday singing thing. But they read the steps, and I had heard of the steps. It's part of the 12-step program. It's part of the language, and more people know the term 12-step program than have ever heard the steps. And so I knew the term. I knew Alcoholics Anonymous was a 12-step program. I may have even known it was the 12-step program, but I had never heard any of the steps until that night when someone read them, and they had them on the wall, and I read them on the wall, and I saw them. I didn't know that the 12. I thought that Alcoholics Anonymous was the smart way to get sober. I thought it was the secular way to get sober without God, because my grandmother was a Pentecostal minister. Pentecostal Christ, Church of Jesus Christ, was what they sometimes call a holy roller church. They made a joyful noise. And all of them, all at the same time. Whenever anybody was speaking, somebody would be saying, you know, I owe my soul to the Jesus Christ. Yes, Jesus. Oh, praise the Lord. Oh, yes. Amen. You know, and so I go down to my grandmother's church, you know, for the dancing. And I didn't find out 2 years later they weren't actually dancing. But my grandmother's mission was in a tough part of Los Angeles, in San Pedro, the port of Los Angeles, in a real tough waterfront area called Beacon Street. And in the 50s and 60s, that was a tough area that people were killed there every night. And my grandmother's church was right there, her mission. And she used to help drunks to get sober, wharf rats and winos, to get sober. And she would feed them soup and Jesus. And so I knew you could get sober on soup and Jesus. I had seen it done. But it just never seemed worth it to me. And I thought when I came to AA, this would be the secular way to get sober, the way the smart people got sober without God. So I was disappointed that people went 18 years without drinking, and I was disappointed about all the God stuff. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. Whoa, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, in case you missed it, in the next step it's, God, as we understood him, and then other steps, admitted to God, to ourselves, and humbly asked him with a capital H, power greater than ourselves. I'm going, oh, no, it's a God thing. It's like a church, you know. It's just like my grandmother's church, only they swear. And so I took this book home, The Only Authority on Alcoholics, and I started to read it. And I wanted to read this book. That's an exaggeration. I didn't read the book, but I have the ability to look at the title of a chapter in any book and know everything that's in the chapter. It's a gift that I have. And so I got this book out, and I poured a shot of whiskey, and I sat down and started to read this book. And I thumbed, doctor's opinion. I don't need to read that. I've had doctor's opinions. I know what it is. It's, son, you ought to not drink so much. All right, next. And then I came to chapter one, Bill's story. Who cares? Bill, you know. I didn't even answer my own bills. I'm not going to. So chapter two, there is a solution. Well, As a child raised in the 50s on television, I know what there is a solution is. It's a sales pitch, clearly. Young man, there's a solution to your problem. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams. Next, chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Evidently, in There's a Solution, they said something about alcoholism, and this is even more about alcoholism. Fascinating, I'm sure. Maybe I'll read it sometime. Chapter 4, We Agnostics. Here it is. Here it is. Here's how the smart people get sober without God. Those idiots at the meeting that I went to tonight are talking all about this higher power stuff. I want to thank my higher power I choose to call God. And you know what? Here in the Only Authority on Alcoholics Anonymous is the chapter, We Agnostics. Here's how we do it. So I poured another shot of whiskey just for chapter 4, and I read chapter 4 beginning to end. And when I finished it, I thought, All right, I'm spacing out. I totally missed the whole smart people stay sober without God thing. So I another shot of whiskey and read chapter 4 again. And I finished it. All right, focus. You are not paying attention. Read it again. Another shot of whiskey. I did this 6 times. 6 shots, 6 readings. Eventually, some of it got through. Because it wasn't saying what I wanted it to say, I was like, the first paragraph says, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't stop drinking entirely, or once you start, you have little control over the amount you take, then you are probably an alcoholic. And if this be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. First paragraph, chapter 4. But I know what I must have been doing. Yeah. Where's the smart people stuff? So that's why I read this thing 6 times, but it's good that I did, because some of it actually did stick. I remember being knocked off my chair, or else I fell off. I don't know, that happens sometimes too, but when I read this simple little sentence that I think most of us miss, I really believe that most people, whatever their level of spirituality, when they first read this sentence in chapter 4, don't realize the significance of it because it's so subtle and seemingly so true that we just go past it. And it says, we have found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. And whatever your level of spirituality, when you read that, I don't think most people are shocked by it. But it's shocking. It's very significant. We have found, not we suspect, not it seems to be, the evidence would indicate, we have found, this is what we found, that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. That is not what I heard anyplace else. I was openly hostile to all organized religion when I came to AA. And Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me a tolerance, a love of organized religion when I realized that everybody's taking different paths. But at the time when I got to AA, all the different paths that people take to spirituality seemed to me that somebody would be saying, you know what, come on over here because we got the direct line to God. We got a thing going on with God. It's just, and then somebody else said, don't pay any attention to them. We got the thing over here. We got the God thing. We're connected to God. This is the way God told us to do it. Oh, okay. No. We are the way, the truth, and the life over here. Come on over. Finally, I just got turned so many different directions that I just turned, it would seem like it was more fun to just make fun of them. Way too much education in LSD to believe in any of that crap. Some meetings in AA in the United States where they don't like you to talk about illegal drugs. I don't, okay, well, I don't know. I mean, I like to point out to them that alcohol was an illegal drug when Bill and Bob were using it. I didn't know. I mean, I'm enough of a people pleaser that if I had known where my life was going to go, you can't see, down the path that far. But if I had known, the first time somebody said, hey, man, try this, I would have said, oh, man, I'd love to, but I'm going to be speaking at an AA meeting in 30 years and I don't want to pay anybody off, But I want you to know that I only used every drug I ever heard of. And the ones I didn't care for, I only used like 3 or 4 times. I'm looking at this sentence that we have found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. And I didn't hear that from anybody. I never heard it any place but Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe some other people said it, but this is the only place I ever heard it. It seemed to me that they all said, we think God makes very hard terms on those who seek him, and here's the terms that God told us to do. And it's my grandmother's Pentecostal church. They didn't say, they said my name in less than a syllable. They're all Southern, Southern U.S., Doug, we believe that God makes very hard times on those who seek him. In fact, God will not even hear your prayers unless you are baptized. And I don't mean sprinkled on the forehead like some Methodist.
I'm talking about total submersion. That's why we got this tub of water up here, boy. Come on up. We're going to soak you down, pull you up, wash in the blood of the Lamb. Praise Jesus. Amen. Somebody hand the boy a towel.
And that seems a little over the top to me, Grandma. And then I had a girlfriend who was Catholic, and she was happy with her religion. Her whole family was Catholics, and she, you know, worked for her. I didn't say anything, but she had to go to confession, communion, confirmation, a bunch of other cons, so she could find out how many Our Fathers and Hail Marys she had to say to cleanse herself of all the various kinds of sin, cardinal and venial and menial, and I don't know, some that you didn't, all you had to do was think about them, you know, and then, you know, I said, I don't know. And then she would cleanse herself by doing all these things that they told her to do, and she still couldn't talk to God. Her deal was like to talk to God's mom. Hello, Mrs. God. No, this is Julie. No, don't wake him up. Just tell him I love him. Okay, bye. And so I didn't understand that. And I had a friend, my friend Michael was an Orthodox Jew. They were happy in their religion. Their home was a warm home that you wanted to walk into. There was a warmth in there that you could feel when you walked into the Rothberg home. All my friends loved to go over there. And we would go over and Mrs. Rothberg would say, oh, Doug, welcome to our home. She was like she'd been waiting all week for me to come. And she was like that with everyone. Doug, welcome to our home. Would you like to join us in some wine and challah? I'm sorry, what? Would you like to join us in some wine and challah? Well, I'll have some wine. I'm not much of a pastry eater, and then Michael and I went out to lunch one time, and we're having lunch, we're talking, he orders a BLT, hold the bacon. You know BLT, bacon, lettuce, tomato, hold the bacon. I said, Michael, you just ordered a salad on toast. What is that? You know, he said, oh, well, I to eat the flesh of the cloven hoofed animal is to offend he whose name cannot be uttered. So. What? Pork. I can't eat pork. It'll offend he whose name cannot be uttered. Who is that? Can't say his name. Jesus Christ! No, but you're close. And he said, you know. And then there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. Oh, my! And I just turned my back on all of them. I said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm out of here. It's more fun for me to make fun of them. But when I came to AA, that's why I was openly hostile to all organized religions. And then I found this thing in the book that said, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. And I did not have an epiphany when I read that. It just finally got my attention. Okay, make a mental note of that. And then there's another phrase in there that says, I love this. It says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. I know why that is. Because we're alcoholics. Non-alcoholics don't seem to have a problem with that decision. In fact, you can test this one. Get yourself a clipboard and go and stand in front of a market and stop people when they're coming out. Excuse me, I'm taking a survey. Would you rather die an alcoholic death or live a spiritual life? See now it has a different view, doesn't it? Because most of the normies, most non-alcoholics, earth people, they go, I'm sorry, excuse me. What was that? Come on, I need an answer. Alcoholic death, spiritual life. Make up your mind. I haven't got all day. I'll take the spiritual deal. You know, it's like, what the hell? Is this a trick question? Am I on camera? Is this a TV show? You know. But when we say it, when I just said it earlier, people are going, that's right. That's right. Because it's a hard decision for us. That's why it says it in the book. A very inquisitive, normal person might say something like, Now, when you say alcoholic death, you're talking about where you puff up and turn yellow and choke to death on your own blood and vomit when your esophagus erupts inside your throat? Yeah, come on, I haven't got all day. You know? Give me an answer. And they'll take the long line. All of them. In fact, if you do this test, you will know when you found an alcoholic. Excuse me, alcoholic death, spiritual life, and you get this. Boy, you're going to be here tomorrow? I didn't have an easy time in my first months in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a question asker. It's something about I guess it's not true of all alcoholics, but it was certainly true of me and some others that I know. I hate to ask a question. And I know the reason is because if I ask a question, you'll think I don't know the answer. And I don't know what to do about that. One thing I found it works for me sometimes is if I have a question, I'll stand next to somebody that I think knows the answer. You know, maybe I'll want to know what's the capital of Iceland. You know, and I know that Carl is from Iceland. His family's from Iceland, so I'll go stand by Carl and bring up the subject until somebody asks. You know, boy, I heard you're from Iceland, huh? Okay. You know, until somebody asks the question. Hey, Carl, what is the capital of Iceland? And Carl would say Reykjavik, and I'll say that's right. That's right. You know, see, and so I got by with that for a long time. But I'm going to jump all over. This is not chronologically correct, this talk tonight. Oh, I'll get over it. When I got sober, by the time I got sober, I was 21 days sober, and I was real serious about staying sober by the time I actually got sober. And a woman who had been sober 2.5 years, 13 stepped me. And okay, I don't have to explain that one. isn't it? This is a place where we learn about the 13th step before we've taken the first one. Randy took me home and showed me the benefits of sobriety. You know, boy, you wake up with a woman you remember going to bed with. Whoa, this is great. And so we started hanging out, and then she moved into my house, and then we got married. You're not supposed to do that in newcomer relationships. Getting in a relationship in your first month of sobriety obviously can't last. And this one only, you know, just absolutely fell apart after 15 years. But, you know, we got married, and it wasn't good. But Randy, because she was 2.5 years longer than me, was not a sponsor to me, but she was somebody I could ask questions about. And I still didn't ask her questions until I learned to ask questions. And I credit her with teaching me how to ask questions, because one time we were in bed, and I don't know how long I was sober, maybe 9-10 months, and I had my leg on her side of the bed, and she grabbed my leg like a log. And threw it. Get over on your own side of the bed, she said. God, you sleep like Jim Parks. And I'm laying there thinking, okay, I don't know any Jim Parks. He's not anybody I've ever met, and I don't remember ever hearing about him. But Randy read a lot. She read all the time. You know, I could embarrass myself by saying, who's Jim Parks? And she'll go, God, didn't you ever read Catcher in the Rye? You know, or something. You know, so I'm afraid, but on the other hand, I really want to know who Jim Parks is. And I know if I don't say something, I'm going to be thinking about it all the time, more and more. And 2 or 3 days later, you know, she won't know I'm thinking, she won't remember it, but I'll be thinking, Jim, she'll say, are you going to leave your boots in the dining room? And I'll say, hey, boots my ass. Who's Jim Parks? So I had to bite the bullet, and I said, honey, am I supposed to know who Jim Parks is and how he sleeps? And she started to laugh at me. And she cackled when she laughed. you know, Jim across the street. I said, what? What? He moved in after she did. I said, Jim across the street? Yeah, you know how he puts his truck? so you can't park in front of him or behind him. You sleep like Jim Parks. Okay. So that one got past the language barrier. I was a little concerned about it. So I'm going to meetings, and I got all I wanted out of the Big Book, and I would listen to people, what they said about the Big Book, you know, and things that people said, you know, our book says, and I'm like, what? And so I picked up phrases, I like to talk about the music of Alcoholics Anonymous because the words used to make me crazy. I would, you know, they tell you, well, you got to surrender to win. What? That's right. You got to surrender to win and give it away to keep it. Okay. So I'm not going to ask a question. All right, then. Somebody, and in the book, on one page of the book, it says, with regard to alcohol, when tempted by alcohol, we recoil as from a hot flame. On the very next page, it says, with regard to alcohol, we're placed in a position of neutrality. Okay. Which one is it? Is it the hot flame or is it neutrality? Because, you know, it'd be like, we went out to the geyser today and, I wanted to jump in there. It looked real warm, you know, and Thor pointed out that if it wasn't boiling, it wouldn't be blowing up in the air. So that's a hot flame to me. If I were neutral to it, I could just get in and it would be room temperature, you know. So that's what I didn't understand the language, the lyrics. The lyrics blew me away. I didn't know what was going on here. And somebody said to me, well, you know, the road gets narrower. The road gets narrower. I said to I had a friend who was sober about a year longer than me, and I said, hey, Johnny, what's this where the road gets narrower? You know, yeah, that's right. I said, that seems like it would be a little inconvenient, you know, because I did a lot of that one-eyed driving, and the road getting narrower, you know, it seems like. And he said, no, it's, you know, it's a metaphor. I'll tell you what it means. It's like, he said, when I first got sober, I'd smoke in the car, and I'd throw my cigarette out the window. That's just what I did. And he said, one day, it just occurred to me after I was sober for a while, I could start a fire. And so I would put out the cigarette and then throw it out the window. And he said, and then another, further on down the road, I realized, you know what, I'm littering. I'm contributing to the trash of the world. I don't have to do that. Put the cigarette out in the ashtray, leave it, dump the ashtray in a trash can. And then eventually I even quit smoking. So he said, that's what it really means about the road. So now I know what it means. Somebody took the time to explain it to me because I asked a question. And I would go around telling everybody, well, the road gets narrower. Yeah. There's an old timer at the San Fernando group where I got sober, and he was telling his guys, I wasn't part of him, but he was just telling him, he said, I don't know if there was a point to what he was saying or not, because I didn't hear the first part, but he said, the women in Alcoholics Anonymous are the most beautiful women in the world. He should have been here. The women, I can't believe it. I asked Siggy if there was a beauty test you had to pass before you could come through the door here. He assured me, no, the ugly ones are still drinking. But yeah. And all you beautiful ones coming in here must have made it a lot easier for them to get a drink. So they owe you a debt of gratitude. Anyway, this guy was saying to his sponsees, you know, the women in Alcoholics Anonymous are the most beautiful women in the world. They clean up and they dress nice. They smell good. Their hair looks nice. They smile with that inner smile. They're smart. They're funny. They're happy people. But you know what? I'm a married man. I don't play. And I said, the road gets narrower. And the guy turned around and he said, what? Like, act like I was eavesdropping, you know, which I was. And he said, I said, the road gets narrower. You know, alcoholic women, beautiful women, you don't play, married man, road gets narrower. He said, where'd you get that? Where'd you get that? I didn't expect to be questioned on it. I said, out of the book. shouldn't have said it, because I wasn't reading the book, and I didn't know that particular one didn't come out of the book. And he said, oh, really? I knew I was in trouble. And he said, you must have a different book than I have. Oh, man. Oh, no. He's going to do that different book thing on me. Because in my book, on page 55, look out, page numbers. My book on page 55, it says, why don't you come and join us on the broad highway? In fact, in my book on page 75, it says, you're going to feel like you're walking with the spirit of the universe. Guess where? On the broad highway. So my big book says, broad highway twice, road gets narrower, nothing. Let's see your book. No, I was just trying to help, okay? You know, and I wasn't much help around there because I would get in trouble. Like, and also, here's the deal. My first 8 months in AA, I didn't have a home group. I went to a lot of different groups, and I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't read the book. I didn't take the steps. I didn't have a commitment. And I was drinking every day. But other than that, I had a pretty good program going, and the only thing I did right was what the first people that I saw at a meeting told me to do. I kept coming back. First 8 months, that's all I did right. And I started to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, man. I remember sitting in a meeting and thinking, at first I was thinking about the bottle that I had under the seat in my car that I was going to drink on the way home. And people started sharing, and everybody that shared I identified with, and I thought, I am sitting in a room full of Dougs. And I wasn't even sober yet. And it scared me, because I never fit any places, I told you. But now I'm starting to fit in Alcoholics Anonymous, except that I'm drinking. And one night I came home from a meeting, and I had bought a fifth of whiskey, either on the way to the meeting or on the way home. Sometimes I'd buy them on the way to the meeting, put it under the seat, and not open it. It's still sealed. And then on the way home, I'd drink it. Or sometimes I'd show tremendous restraint and wait till I got home to drink it. And I was laying on the floor in my house watching television, drinking this fifth of whiskey, and I passed out. I used to do that all the time. I woke up about 3 a.m., bottle's about half full, television's on. This happened. This is the way I usually woke up. Turned off the TV, got my bottle, crawled on my hands and knees across the living room, through the hallway, into the bedroom to go to bed. And as some people call that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I just called it going to bed. Seemed kind of smart to crawl, and I could crawl holding the bottle easy enough, and you can't fall off the floor, so there you go. So I got into my bedroom, and I stood up to take my clothes off, and when I did, I lost my balance, which was not uncommon. But this time I had a bottle of whiskey in my hand, and when I fell on my knees, the bottle spilled all over the bed. And I picked up the bottle real quick. There was about this much left in it, and I set it in a safe place. And I grabbed this bedspread because there was this little lake of whiskey spreading out into the bedspread. So I grabbed it and gathered it all up and started sucking the whiskey out of it. And I have said this in meetings where people go, ooh. And I say, this is clearly not someone who has ever snorted cocaine off of the floor of a public restroom. And not everyone in AA does that. But that's where the whiskey was. In case you're wondering why I was sucking the whiskey out of the bedspread, that's where it was. And the fact that I was done drinking for the night had nothing to do with it. The fact that there was whiskey in the bottle in case I was thirsty, didn't enter into it. The whiskey was in the bedspread. It would evaporate if I left it overnight. And I am not a person who wastes whiskey. I'll waste my life, but not whiskey. And I was sucking the whiskey out of this bedspread, there was a voice in my head, an audible voice in my head that said, hey, man, that ain't right. What? That ain't right, man. You can't argue with that voice in your head. Ain't right. Are you thirsty? I'm not thirsty. I'm frugal. I'm not a person who wastes things, you know. I looked at myself sucking whiskey out of a bedspread, and I thought, man, what's wrong with me? You know, I've been going to AA for 8 months regularly,
and I have not learned how to not suck whiskey out of a bedspread. Maybe I'm one of those losers. One of those AA losers that hangs out outside the Alano Club for 20 years and never gets sober. And people that came in after me will be walking through with their sponsees and say, look at that. You want to end up like Doug? Take the steps. Man, that's a horrible thing to think you're going to end up being. And I saw no other direction for me to go. I had other plans for my life. And I didn't know what to do. I did maybe the dumbest thing I have ever done. I said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I say it was dumb because I didn't believe there was anybody to listen. I did not believe in God. I was positive there was no such thing as God. And I felt simultaneously sorry for people who did think it and envious of them because they were not as smart as me and they could call upon a God who didn't exist and it seemed to help them. But I was way too smart. But when I was desperate, when I was absolutely crying, screaming, not knowing where to go, my life is going in the gutter, desperate, I said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I meant it. Didn't think anybody was listening. Went to bed, went to sleep. And over the next couple of weeks, interesting things happened to me. The next day I went into a liquor store in my neighborhood. And there was somebody from AA in the liquor store behind the counter. Behind the counter. There could only have been one of three people behind that counter, night or day. I knew all of them. They knew me. I could walk into that liquor store, lay a $5 bill on the table, and they would give me a half pint of Bushmills and my change. That's the relationship that I had with this liquor store. But I walked in there the next day after I said that prayer, and there's a guy from AA in there. I said, see, and I didn't tell people in AA that I was drinking. Some of them noticed it. In California, they give chips for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 6 months of sobriety, 9 months of sobriety. I had taken a lot of chips. Every once in a while, I got, you know, anybody in their first 30 days, Doug, alcoholic. Anybody with less than 30 days, Doug, alcoholic. Anybody in the first 30 days of sobriety, less than 30 days, Doug, alcoholic, Doug, alcoholic, Doug, alcoholic. I just got tired of raising my hand one day, and they said, anybody with less than 30 days, and I started to raise it, and I said, you know what, it's none of their business. None of their business. It's embarrassing to do this. I've been coming here for 6-8 weeks, and I still have less than 30 days, and I'm drinking every day. It's going to be a long time before I have 30 days. So I didn't raise my hand, and then a girl that was sitting at the table said to her friend, oh, Doug's got 30 days, because I didn't raise my hand, and I realized what had happened. I didn't mean to deceive anybody. But I didn't know what to do. So then they said, anybody want to take a 30-day chip? So I didn't want to embarrass her. So I took a 30-day chip. I make her look like a fool. She was on my 13-step list. Took a 30-day chip, and everybody was like delighted. Yay, Doug! All right, Doug! So I thought, I made these alcoholics so happy. And I went spreading joy all over Los Angeles. Taking 30-day chips. And then every once in a while, somebody would smell me. And they'd say, you smell like whiskey. You've been drinking. And you know, you have nothing to do, really. If a sober alcoholic says, you smell like whiskey, you smell like, what are you going to do? Oh, I was on a 12-step call, and some newcomer spilled it all over me. Got it in my pores, my mouth, everything. Yeah, I'm fine. So I would say, yeah, I drank, you know. Let you down. Oh, no, you didn't let us down. You're an alcoholic. You're going to drink. Welcome back, you know. Take a newcomer chip. They had newcomer chips. Okay. So now I got a different sobriety date at that meeting, you know. But I still have my other one at some other ones that I was going to. I had four different sobriety dates by the time I got different meetings, you know. But this week of after I said this prayer, I had no intention of stopping drinking. I went in that liquor. I didn't buy any alcohol at that liquor store. I went to another liquor store and got it. And then a couple days later, I was at a restaurant. I was at a Mexican restaurant in a part of town that I hadn't been in normally and started to order a drink. And the waitress is somebody I know from AA. Hey, how you doing? It's like, good to see you. Yeah. I'm in the market, in the supermarket, in the liquor department. And pushing my cart through the liquor department, I reach up for a bottle. Somebody from AA is pushing a cart towards me. Hey, one day at a time. Keep it simple. Isn't it a beautiful life? So this was happening to me all the time, and one time, and for a couple of weeks, it was happening every day. And after a couple of weeks went by, I was on the way to work one morning at 6:30 in the morning, and I just finished a half pint of Bushmills Irish whiskey. And in California, it's against the law to have open containers, even if they're empty. So, and plus, they're useless. So I roll down the window, and I was going to throw it out the window, and a guy from AA is coming towards me at 6:30 in the morning, and he sees me. Hey, and he waves, and I threw a bottle out the window, and you know, and it made that noise. But ding, 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 you know. And I thought, where are these people coming from? Every time I reach for a drink, there's some AA member. Hey, welcome to AA. Let's have a drink. Rarely have we seen a person fail. Yeah, they're like cockroaches. And I thought, you know, it's like those damn miracles that people talk about in the meetings. As soon as I thought the word miracle, I could hear God laughing. I pulled the car over to the side of the road, and I sat there and thought about I had been on my knees 2 weeks ago. And I said, God, if you're there, please help me. And since then, these weird things have been happening. Things that if you told me the day before they happened to me and called them miracles, I would have said, well, I don't know about miracles. Interesting coincidences, but when they happened to me and I recognized them, and they happened frequently, and way more AA members than the population would indicate, and I recognized them as miracles, and I realized I had been on my knees and asked God for help, and I had clearly gotten the help that I asked for. And I was shocked, and I couldn't drive. And it felt to me like a warm fog came into the car, and I felt safe. And it was my second step. I didn't realize it at the time, but it's the moment that I came to believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. And I still think that's going to happen. I'm in no hurry, you know. God's time. But it's when I started to hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, the music is what saved my life. Because before that moment, before I came to believe, I couldn't hear the music. And as I told you earlier, I have a musical background. And I only heard the lyrics, and they didn't make any sense without the music. And the way I can explain it, when I had been sober for 30 days, I wanted a 30-day chip. I had enough chips to open a casino. But you know, they give you these little poker chips. And I went to the Burbank group, which was a group that gave chips and cakes on Thursday night. And that was like my 30 days. And they said, anybody for 30 days? And I got up and I took a chip, an honest chip. And it was my first honest chip, and I had 30 days. And I said, I'm Doug, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Doug. And I felt like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really felt like a member. And I sat down and watched people take 60s and 90s and 6-month chips and 9-month chips, and people took birthday cakes. And I was just as happy about somebody taking a 1-year cake or a 20-year cake or a 9-month chip as I was about my own chip. And that's not me. That's not who I am. Take my word for it. You know, and I just felt like such an AA member, and I got up, I was glowing. I went to get my coffee at the coffee break, and a guy stopped me there, and he said, congratulations on your 30 days. And I said, thanks. He said, you know what the secret is? And I said, no. Don't drink. Don't drink. And he said, hang on. He said, that's the whole deal here. Hang on. Do you think you can do that? And I said, that's what I've been doing. And he said, keep doing it. See, it took one, and now I know what the secret is. Now I'm like, okay, I know what the secret is, you know. I know some shit now. So I go to get my coffee, and there's a guy named Jim B. at the Burbank group. He's one of these old timers, and they got, you maybe have them up here. In the United States, they got these old timers that are back slapping, hand grabbing alcoholics. Young man, you know, well, you know. And he said, son, congratulations on that 30 days. I said, thanks. And he said, you know what the secret is? I said, yep, hang on. And he said, nope, let go. Okay. All right. The old timers are diametrically opposed on what the secret to sobriety is, but I'm okay with it because I hear the music. And the words are not making a fool of me anymore. I'm not scratching my head over the words here because I'm hearing the music. They're just lyrics. The guy who said, hang on is talking about keep coming back, stay close, stay in the middle of the herd, they say. That's what he's talking about hang on. The guy who said let go is talking about let go and let God. Surrender. Chuck C. used to say, came here tonight to tell you to surrender. Surrender! He would say it twice. And that's the way I feel about the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, because the music made the difference for me. Once I heard the music, the words weren't messing me around. I used to, well, they would read chapter 5 at meetings, how it works, and they would talk about honesty. People who don't get sober seem to be constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And even people with grave emotional and mental disorders can stay sober if they have the capacity to be honest. Not just regular honesty. Oh, no. Rigorous honesty. Yeah, rigorous honesty. We're real serious about this honesty. It's not the kind of honesty you're thinking about. Oh, really? I don't know. I'm not even like the regular kind of honest. You know, I'm not gonna, you know, I'm like the most honest I ever was when my first wife said to me, Doug, tell me the truth. Did you sleep with my sister? And I said, no, not a wink. Because and that's as serious as, you know, as honest as I could be. You don't mean to deceive if you can help it, but sometimes it's just better. And I'll tell you what, I'm 16 years and 3 months sober, and sometimes I'll lie. I only do it when I'm divinely directed. You can tell when God wants you to fib. If my wife says to me, does this dress make me look fat? Rigorous honesty. No, honey, I think it's the Haagen-Dazs. The dress looked fine on the hanger. Let's go try it on the skinny blonde next door. If it makes her look fat, there's something wrong with that dress. Waiters in nice restaurants, I lie to them all the time. When they say, sir, would you like a cocktail before dinner? And I say, no, thank you. Okay, that's okay. It's all right with God. I'm not going to get drunk over that. I might get drunk if I told him the truth. Boy, you know what? I would. I'd like a cocktail instead of dinner. I'd like a mess of them. I'd like a double Bushmills neat and a margarita back and keep them coming. I got a pocket full of plastic. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we're going to party tonight, boy. No, come here. I'm just kidding. I'm playing with you. Because actually, it turns out I have a disease. Physical allergy, mental obsession, spiritual bankruptcy. Do you want that in your nice restaurant? Huh? So that's when it said rigorous, you know, when you start to hear the music, the words are not. I lied to my sponsor one time. Oh, maybe more than once. But one time, you're not supposed to lie to your sponsor. That's like self-honesty. That's the kind of honesty you're not. But my sponsor, Steve, at the time, I called him. I said, God, Randy and I had this argument. Listen to this. She's wrong. Listen. And I told him, and he didn't say she was right or wrong. She was. She was wrong. And he said, well, I see your point. You know, would you rather be right or happy? And I lied to him. I said, right. No, I said, happy. That's right. I lied. Yeah. Because there's nothing makes me happier than being right. And happy, but I know that happy is the right answer, and I said that. I'm gonna let the cat out of the bag here. Sometimes people who are sober a long time will misquote the big book, and I may have done it tonight. I hope I didn't, but if I did, if I did, listen. If you know what I said, and you go check it out in the book, and it turns out that isn't what the book says, I'm okay with that, and I would like for you to call me. My number in the United States is area code 818-353-4607. Call me and tell me where I misquoted the book. I love that. I hardly ever get calls like that, but I love it. That means somebody's reading the book, you know? But I wasn't reading the book when I was newly sober. I wanted people to tell me what it said. A woman said, our book says, I'm listening. She says, our book says that our drinking was but a symptom of deeper underlying causes and conditions. It does. It says exactly that. Then she went on to add her own stuff without saying, if you add your own stuff, you're supposed to say, and my opinion is. But she didn't do that. She was on a roll. She said, and if you don't find your deeper underlying cause and condition, you're going to get drunk again. You will drink again. Well, I thought that was in the book. I didn't know she made that up. And I don't know what my deeper underlying cause and condition is. I have no idea. I was going out with this girl. Somebody said, if you get her drunk, you'll get a home run, you know, which is like, and it's a baseball term, but, you know, you can imagine what it means. So I bought a bottle of Rainier Ale, which was the national beverage of the town where I grew up. And we, I said, here, you know, I didn't want to drink. I would have been happy to say, here, drink this, you know, and let me know when you're ready. but I just drank some. She drank some, and it turned out my friend was right. You know, I did get a home run that night, and I got drunk, and I like both those things. So I'm going to do both these things as much as I can the rest of my life. And so I don't know what my deeper underlying cause and condition was. I didn't come from an alcoholic family. I know a lot of people in AA do, but my dad was the kind of guy who would buy a six-pack of beer and drink one and put five in the refrigerator, and they would stay in the refrigerator a week. He didn't think about them. You know, I got nothing against refrigerators. I just don't think it should get five and I should get one. My dad would be working on a car, you know, on a Saturday, or watching a game, or working in the yard. He'd stop and have a beer, you know, drink the beer, go back to what he was doing. I don't drink like that. If I have a beer, that's what I'm doing. And whatever I was doing before couldn't have been very important, or why would I stop to have a beer? So I don't know what my deeper underlying cause and condition. My mother may be an alcoholic. I don't know. You can't tell because she won't drink. And if they won't drink, you can't tell. And I would watch her, you know. I mean, when I got sober, I wanted to know why I'm an alcoholic. What is this? Maybe I'm some other kind of alcoholic that doesn't, you know, can only go like a couple of years without drinking, then you're okay or something, you know. And I didn't have this genetic predisposition. And I asked my mother one time, why don't you drink? Are you an alcoholic? And she was like, what? I don't know. I don't know. Maybe. She said, when I was young, I used to drink. And every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, and obnoxious. So I just quit. And I said, well, you got to drink through that. So I don't know why I'm an alcoholic, but it doesn't matter why I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. And you heard this part, Earl? Okay. So he hates this part of my story. So so I'm looking back over my life to see why I'm an alcoholic. What's my problem? What's the turning point in my life? And I realized when I was 24 years old, I went to a theater to see a show called Hair. It was hippies. See, it was 1969. Hippies singing and dancing, and it was a Broadway show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And there was a character named Berger that swung on a rope and stripped down to a loincloth and screaming rock and roll. And I I could do that. So I went to audition for this show. Well, I didn't go. Actually, what happens, the next day I called them at the theater and I said, I want to be in your show. And they said, okay. See, they should have said, have your agent call us. But they didn't. They said, this is 1969. It was a different thing. And they said, come down Friday at 1 o'clock. You got an audition. What's your name? And told them, they wrote down, Friday at 1 o'clock, I got an audition. So I'm Friday morning, I'm home with my guitar practicing the song I'm going to sing, because I know this is a Broadway show and I can sing. I'm a singer. And I'm not a dancer. I don't know how to dance. I've never danced in my life. And this is a Broadway show. But maybe if I sing good enough, and I'm a singer, they'll say, I don't care if you can dance. Just come and sing with us, you know. So I'm practicing the song I'm going to sing, and I broke a string on my guitar. And hippies in 1969, we were like, oh, bad karma, man. You know, and so I went into my roommate's room to see if he had the string that I needed. And there it was, right on his dresser, a little in its little envelope, the D string. And now I'm like, oh, good karma. So I picked up this, and underneath the little envelope, there was a white capsule. I thought, I wonder what this is. you know, we didn't have a physician's desk reference. You had to swallow test everything, that's the way we found out what it was. And, you know, if somebody died, you'd go, don't eat the green shit. And, you know, it's real simple. So it turned out this was THC, a synthetic marijuana, which was a very nice psychedelic. And so by the time I got down to the Aquarius Theater to do my audition, I was floating. I just floated in there. And I had, my hair was long over my shoulders and it swished when I walked. And I had this vest on. It was six layers of red, white, and blue leather fringe, foot long, you know, and no shirt on. And I was like a walking wind chime when I walked in there floating. And they called my name and they had told me to bring some sheet music. And they Doug Rowley, yes, I'm right here. I went up on the stage, and I handed my sheet music to the piano player, and he opened it, and he smiled. Oh, yeah, good choice, you know. And he started to play. Bump, 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 bump. I said, wow, I feel good. See, there's your rigorous honesty. I felt very good. And I did this James Brown song, and I thought I was the godfather of soul. I couldn't fall down if I wanted to. I finished and they said, great, man, great. Screaming rock and roll. We love that. Can you do something a little mellower just so we can get a range? Sure. So I went into an a cappella version of Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay. And the piano player picked it up and fell in with me and we were in the pocket. Looks like nothing's gonna change. And I was just, oh man, I made myself cry. And, finished and they said, great, man, great. We just got to see you dance. I said, hit it. And the piano player started to play and I started to move. And I see my hair coming around. And the fringe on this vest is going. And I heard somebody say, Jesus, can he dance? Yeah, because, you know, alcohol and drugs did for me what I couldn't do for myself. That's why I hung on to it till the bitter end. And they hired me. They hired me to go to Las Vegas where they were opening a new show so they could I could play the part of this crazy speed freak, sex-crazed leader of the tribe. It was a stretch, but I could do it. And we did 6 months in Vegas, and then we went on the road. And we went on the road, and we'd go all over the United States and Canada and do the show for a week here and 2 weeks there and 3 weeks here. And we did this for 3.5 years, 3 years, half a year in Vegas and 3 years on the road. And I looked back, and it was a great experience. I mean, people would come up to us after the show and say, you were beautiful, man. You were beautiful. Have some pot, man. Sensimian, Maui Wowie, Panama Red. Cool. Somebody else would come up and go, great, man. Have some acid, man. Window pane, Osley, Purple Haze, Orange Sunshine. Oh, cool. You know, somebody give us all these drugs for free. And then some girl would come up and go, I love you. Take me. And I went, well, okay then. It was a good job. But I looked back at that experience and said, man, they used me. They took advantage of me. I just wanted to sing and dance and make people happy, you know. And they ruined me. They made me a drug addict and an alcoholic. And now I'm in AA. I called my sponsor. I said, hey, I found it. What'd you find now? My deeper underlying cause and condition? Oh, let's hear that. He said, hair? Said, hair? Maybe if we shave your hair off, you can stay sober. Not my hair, the show hair. Remember I told you when I used to be a big star, I'd travel around the country and, you know, oh yeah, big star, I forgot about that, yeah. But you told me you were loaded when you auditioned for that show. Yeah, yeah. I had told him too much. And he said, let me tell you something. Most people, non-alcoholic people, when they go to interview for a job they really want, won't take a drug they can't identify. Okay, he clearly learned that at sponsor school. And so I said, all right, then I don't know what my deeper underlying cause and condition is. Maybe I'll get drunk. And he said, maybe you will. But if you do, you're going to have to swallow alcohol. Don't do that. Meanwhile, if you want to look for it, fine, I'll give you something to do between meetings. Tomorrow, you go to another meeting. Tomorrow you call me, and tomorrow you read that book. My first sponsor told me, you read that book every day. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. If you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. You need to stay on it. You need to do it every day. And that's the best advice I ever got in AA. He said, we're not in a hurry with this thing, but you need to stay on it. And that was great advice for me. And I never did find my deeper underlying cause and condition. I finally settled on trauma from circumcision. You know, I don't remember it, but it must have been traumatic. It would make me a little restless, irritable, and discontented today if it happened. So I don't know, you know. But what I did find in here was the music, and that has worked for me for 16 years and 3 months. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, please stay close. Stay close. You will hear the music. There's a rhythm and a harmony and a melody that runs through this thing, and it makes the words make sense. And when you hear it, you'll say, that's what that guy was talking about. That's what he was talking about. In fact, if you shared a laugh with us tonight, that's the music. That's it. You're part of the band. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous.